Note to listeners, listener discretion is advised as this program may contain strong language, in some cases right from the fucking start. From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 141 of Little Brother for the 23rd of December, 2023. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com, or you can post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. NPR is reporting that the biggest tech trial of the century is now underway, the target of which is Alphabet, better known as Google. Similar to how Microsoft got slapped around in the 90s over using their monopoly power to push users into Internet Explorer, Google stands accused of using its monopoly power to push users to their search engine. The very fact that the search engine's name has become a verb, meaning to look something up on the internet, speaks to the power that they wield. Meanwhile, Epic Games has won a court case against Google. In their case, Epic challenges Google's collection of a 30% transaction fee for sales made via the Google Play Store. Intriguing enough, the Android platform, where the Google Play Store is the native software manager, is completely capable of using alternative software managers as well as or instead, and the software can also be sideloaded without a software manager. This, however, requires a certain level of expertise, so much like Google the search engine wins by being the default, so does Google the Play Store. The news isn't all bad for Google, though. Google has taken steps to ensure that our history location data is kept on a shorter leash. Google is making available options to retain less of your travel timeline in the Maps app in order to ensure that the information is not available for legal or other discovery. Last episode, I reported that the government had been capturing our push notifications. The Verge is reporting that Apple is taking steps to curtail that. In response to some concerns expressed by Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, Apple have taken to requiring a court order to produce the contents of push notifications. The Verge is reporting also that Google already had such a policy in place. In a development that should surprise nobody, NBC is reporting that police in some jurisdictions have taken to using drones to patrol the areas outside shopping malls during the Christmas season. Speaking of surveillance, the Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, has published a notice that Rite Aid pharmacies will be prohibited from using facial recognition technology in their stores for a period of 5 years, or until safeguards have been put into place. The order is the result of a complaint filed a few years ago that the drugstore had been using artificial intelligence to identify potential shoplifters and other troublemakers, and that they had failed to combine it with measures to prevent harm to customers who were erroneously accused. Reuters has a report of a woman who was in the process of separating from her abusive husband and discovered that he had been stalking her by way of the location technology in her 2016 Tesla Model X. The discovery came when he had located the vehicle and left a metal baseball bat, the same one that he'd been using to beat her, in the back of the car for her to find. The story headlines about her suing Tesla over his access to the car and losing the case. However, I believe that that is burying the lead. The real story here is that contemporary cars know too much about us and are capable of being questioned remotely. Finally, a user of General Motors' ChatGPT-powered customer service chat discovered that he could easily persuade the chatbot to agree to sell him a 2024 Chevy Tahoe for the low, low price of $1, and to assert that it is legally binding. I do not, however, expect this to be legally binding, and I do not expect General Motors to honor the deal. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned Recently? I have two for you today. First up is Comcast Xfinity. They are, of course, the cable company and sole internet service provider in large swathes of the country. The Verge is reporting that a Citrix vulnerability was exploited, exposing names, contact information, social security numbers, and birth dates of customers. Could somebody please explain to me why an ISP needs birth dates or social security numbers? It's a very simple transaction. They pipe data to location X in exchange for currency. If the currency stops, so does the data. So what they need to know is where the site is that the data is to be piped to and enough information to collect their currency. None of that requires a date of birth or social security number. Anyway, 35 million customers are believed to be impacted. The second pwn this fortnight is the First American Financial Corporation, which I honestly didn't know was still around. All of their branches around here were bought up by KeyBank decades ago, but I digress. What I will give them credit for is handling the crisis well. They had a cybersecurity incident, and the first thing they did was what some folks refer to as raising the drawbridge. Everything was taken offline to protect systems from further damage. Kudos, guys. It should come as a surprise to none of you that I despise vendor lock-in, and I detest software lockout. If the thing that you are selling me is a service, fine, you can turn off the tap when I decide to get service from someone else, but if you sold me a physical good and then designed it to stop operating when I stop paying you, that is not cool. In the past, I've expressed my disgust over agricultural equipment maker John Deere engaging in this kind of behavior, making it so that only John Deere authorized service providers can perform repairs. If your crop is rotting in the field waiting for John Deere to send a tech, too fucking bad. So, if I had to pay to get a service such as content or connectivity or, I don't know, electricity, Even service upgrades. Well, okay, yeah, that's fine. However, if I have to get my repairs from you, or if you can turn off features of my bought and paid for product because I stopped paying you some extortion fee, fuck you straight to hell. So, I mentioned all of that context to tell you about a story about trains. The trains in question were powered by Impulse 45 WE locomotives made by Polish train maker Nevag and purchased and operated by Lower Silesian Railways. However, when it came time for their 1 million kilometer service, Nevag lost the bid to a company called Serwis Pojazdów Szynowych. And rather than try to say that a second time, I'll just call them SPS from here on out. The million kilometer service is a full teardown and overhaul of the machine. They were completely taken apart. Parts were replaced or sent off for rebuilds. There were 11 of these locomotives, and the work was done at a cost of about $5.5 million, about $750,000 less than Nevag wanted to perform the service. With the overhauls completed, the engines were turned over, the generators were generating, but they wouldn't move. No matter what they did, the variable frequency drives that provided the tailored AC power to the traction motors just would not, well, provide tailored AC power to the traction motors. There didn't seem to be anything wrong with them, except that they just wouldn't do their job. SPS threw a Hail Mary. Someone typed Polish hackers into Google, and they found a team called Dragon Sector. Long story short, too late, I know, they were able to compare machine states between the locomotives that did not run and others that were not yet due for service, and they found a configuration of flags that could be set to make them run again. After months of elapsed time and hundreds of hours of reverse engineering, it was discovered that a set of coordinates were actually programmed into the train's control systems. 53.13845 by 17.99011. Those turned out to be the coordinates of one of Nevag's repair centers. It seems as though the locomotives were geofenced. Isn't that cute? Now, I would be derelict in my duty if I didn't mention the view from the other side. For their part, Nevag denies the claim that they geofenced these train sets. That's it. People often comment about how uncanny targeted advertising can be. Well, maybe it was just confirmation bias that we saw an ad for a television while we were thinking about one. Or maybe the ad for the new phone showed up because we were just browsing for them on Amazon. Or maybe this one just showed up out of coincidence. Whatever. You get the idea. Stuff you can write off as, nah, we're just being paranoid. Well, no, it seems our devices actually are sometimes listening to us. 404 Media have turned up two confirmed cases of it. The first instance comes to us about Cox Media Group, or CMG, which many will recognize as your local cable company or internet provider. The term they are using for it is active listening, which I find especially annoying, as active listening is used as a positive term in other fields, such as therapy. But how do we know? Well, it's simple. It's in the ad copy. It reads, quote, "What would it mean for your business if we could target potential clients who are actively discussing their need for your services in their day-to-day conversations? No, it's not a Black Mirror episode. It's voice data, and CMG has the capabilities to use it to your business's advantage," end quote. That's pretty damning. The other instance is about a company called MindSift, and they were bragging about this technology on their vodcast. Now, the vodcast in question was posted on their YouTube channel, and this episode has since been edited to remove this, but thankfully, 404 preserved it. Here, have a listen to this.
Say somebody says the roof is leaking, they actually say it near their phone. You want to make sure that you are tapping into that opportunity and being able to connect with these people on a one-to-one basis. Hey, I offer roofing. By the way, you know when you're running an ad to them, when you're doing it this way, you know the person has a leaky roof.
Again, pretty damning. Some years ago, my son brought home an Amazon Echo device, and I told him that I was not happy about that being in my house, and that if it ever appeared on the Wi-Fi, I was revoking his internet access. I now feel even more that that was a solid stance to take. All right, so if you feel the way about tech that I do, what I'm about to do will not impact you in any way. The rest of you deserve what is about to happen. Hey Siri, okay Google, Alexa, play Last Christmas by Wham. Congratulations, you have all just lost Whamageddon. How about something a little lighthearted? The Ship of Theseus is a thought experiment in which the question is asked, if you built a ship and then over time, one by one, replaced all of the parts to repair it as needed, would it still be the same ship? Reddit user Big Hole Energy made an interesting observation about the Wikipedia article about the Ship of Theseus. It was originally added to Wikipedia in July of 2003, and in the 20 years to follow it, it has been edited 1,792 times, leaving absolutely nothing unchanged. This is one of the most beautifully meta things ever, making the article about the Ship of Theseus a perfect example of the very thing it is about. For as far back as I can remember, which is nearly half a century, there have been these wonderful devices called scanning receivers. Often they are colloquially called police scanners. I can remember most of their evolution, from radios with only four channels, which you had to configure by plugging in quartz crystals, to their current incarnation that can follow a trunked conversation under computer control as it bounces from frequency to frequency and tune in all of the various digital modes now in use. Of course, they can be used for other sorts of listening as well. You can listen in on the chatter of ham radio operators, listen to folks using FRS walkie-talkies that you can get in any department store, GMRS, MURS radio operators. If you're near a railroad track, you can listen in on the traffic of passing trains. If you're near a navigable waterway, you can listen in on shipping traffic. Other first responders besides police, such as the fire department, ambulances in your area, you can even get a weather report from the National Weather Service. But there is one insurmountable barrier. If the communications are encrypted, you're getting nothing. Now, obviously, the question from there becomes, why is that a problem? Yes, there is definitely the component of taking people's toys away. I get that. I'm one of those people. However, that's an interest. It's annoying to me, but it's not a reason. However, journalists, accountability groups, and even volunteer first responders, such as firefighters or paramedics, have a legitimate interest in hearing what's going on. So, I put the question to the Albany 2600 group. Let's hear what they've got to say. Do you listen to police scanners?
All the time.
I can't say I do.
No.
No. Okay.
Yes, from time to time.
I did just the other day.
Yes.
Occasionally, yeah.
What is your feeling about police communications becoming encrypted?
It's a very tough question. Politically,
the way I lean and whatnot, and my family has served in the NYPD for a very, very long time. I'm also in the interest of personal freedom. A number of years ago, I don't remember how long it was, a long time ago, there was a court case where the police were, it was confirmed that they were allowed to lie. And I've forever had a large issue with that. Their purpose is to serve and protect. And while there's a great argument for why you would encrypt communication to keep things quiet, why the police would lie and things like that, it doesn't matter to me. That's not how it should work. The rules are the rules. They're protectors. They're servers of the community. We should have full oversight, the full ability to see what they can do at all times. That is our right as a citizen, and that should be upheld to the ostensible end of the law, no matter what.
If that encryption leads to civilians no longer being able to listen to police communications over the air, I would have to say that the cons outweigh the pros. With all due respect, I don't think police are under-equipped to deal with the vast majority of civilian interactions, how aggressive or non-aggressive they may be. I do not think that police claims that lack of encryption puts officers in danger. On paper, I can understand where that argument is coming from, but from a practical standpoint, I don't think that it currently presents a tangible risk to law enforcement the nation over.
Okay.
This communication has existed for decades and decades, and law enforcement and criminals are perpetually in an arms race, and this doesn't seem to have been a major component of that arms race at any point that I'm aware of.
I feel like it's an American tradition to be able to monitor the action. It's a pastime, has been for decades.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an important part of journalism. Police scanner was standard issue in any newsroom, whether that be TV, radio, or print news. I'm not 100% on this, but my understanding is that it is kind of a American phenomenon. I've gone hunting for scanner feeds in European countries and they just don't exist. And I don't have the definitive explanation why that is, but I take it to be that listening to police broadcasts on scanners is something uniquely American, perhaps. But I'd hate to see it go. Obviously, there's also the accountability factor.
I would say I'm not thrilled. Police have been using radio technology for, if not a century, certainly the better part of a century.
Mm.
And for all of that time up until now, they've been more or less accessible to the public. So this represents a shift. As with any other public policy, it's subject to change, but I would like there to be a good reason for change and for that change to be generally positive. And I'm not convinced that that's the case here.
You know, that's interesting. I mean, it's public. So why would you encrypt that?
I think it's an interesting topic. On the one hand, you have the need to keep things secret when they're doing tactical communications. You know, mm-hmm. you don't want to have the bad guys listening in on it. On the other hand, you also want to have oversight. You want to have public oversight,
mm-hmm.
which I think is also important. So there needs to be a way to balance those two. And I think actually post hoc balance is one possible decent solution. You know, you have that Freedom of Information Act that allows release of information that was originally encrypted. I think that's an interesting way of doing it.
You peeked at my notes, didn't you?
Those were, in order of first appearance, the voices of Tim the Enchanter, Anonymous, Finnegan, Deathflower, The Axe That Slayed Me, Fungaboo, and Sky Raider. Now, there is a little bit of interesting news on this front, at least here in New York State. By way of a compromise, there is a bill in the Senate, Bill S7759, which will establish a way for journalists and accountability groups to gain real-time access to encrypted radio communications from those police departments within the state, should they decide to go that route. In OPSEC news, we have some good news and we have some bad news. I'll start with the bad news. As I've probably mentioned at some time in the past, I use Signal Private Messenger as my primary messaging app. It's secure, user-friendly, cross-platform, all the good things. A lot of Signal's funding has been provided by the federal government. Why? Well, as a matter of foreign policy, it's been useful to have a secure messaging platform that could be used to assist dissidents in other parts of the world. However, that has now come to an end, and Signal is facing collapse as a result. It is yet to be seen whether or not the collapse can or will be staved off by donations. However, the platform has remained consistently non-commercial, and to be blunt, the idea of it going commercial scares me more than having it government-funded. Now for the good news. I could have sworn this matter was settled a decade or more ago, but it has new legs. In the state of Utah, the state Supreme Court has issued a ruling that arrestees cannot be compelled to give up the passcodes to their devices. The ruling is based on an interpretation of the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which grants us the very well-known right to remain silent. As always, when dealing adversarially with law enforcement, every day is Shut the Fuck Up Friday. As usual, we'll end the show with the fail of the fortnight. Last month, David M. Schwartz, a lawyer who has been representing Michael Cohen in a certain high-profile case, made an assertion about past precedents that might impact his client's case. The court seemed somewhat skeptical and asked for three examples, for which Schwartz named U.S. v. Figueroa Flores, U.S. v. Ortiz, and U.S. v. Amaro. He included case numbers, dates, summaries, you know, all of the things that you would normally need to summarize and confirm. You know, the way citations are done. There's just one problem. Not one of the cases exists. The judge responded by issuing an order to show cause not to sanction Schwartz. That's basically the legal equivalent of a parent saying, "Give me one good reason why I shouldn't ground you for this." As it turns out, Schwartz can't find the cases either. Now, some of you may recall, back in June, in episode 131, that the fail of the week went to a lawyer named Schwartz. Believe it or not, it's a different Schwartz. That was Steven Schwartz, but the same thing happened. The lawyers submitted to the court a completely made-up list of case citations. The other thing that this pair of Schwartz has in common is that both committed this foul by letting ChatGPT write their citations. Of course, it goes without saying that David Schwartz would have been unaware of the situation that Steven Schwartz had run into. You know, because you would have to do research to figure that out. And if he was willing to do research, he probably would not have turned to ChatGPT to do it for them. Don't you just hate it when your Schwartz gets twisted? Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fungaboo and the Crowded Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 Group. Special thanks to Azriel, Free Scholar Family Tree, The Axe That Slayed Me, Anonymous, Knight Rider 007, Kylo Ren, Alex Matthews, Theo Chino, Joe Cadillac, Spartacus, Thriller at Play, and Julie Bernstein for story leads, and to Tim the Enchanter, Anonymous, Finnegan, Deathflower, The Axe That Slayed Me, Fungaboo, and Sky Raider for appearing in this episode. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Pwned music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Fortnite music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker, and our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next time when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Episode 142 will drop on January 13th. Stay safe and be well.